is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. For over a month, homeless advocates, elected officials, and the courts have negotiated, squared off, and dug in over the fate of camps for homeless men and women. Mayor John Cranley pushed back the latest deadline of noon yesterday to clear a camp on private property in Over the Rhine because various groups were making progress on finding places in shelters for those on the street. To discuss this very fluid situation, we are joined today by WCPO.com reporter Lucy May and Cincinnati Enquirer summer intern and editor of the NKU Northerner, Sam Rosenthal, who is returning to join us again before he goes back to school on Monday. If you would like to join the conversation, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
This is a very fluid situation, and have there been any developments today that either of you have heard about, or are we still now waiting for a new, this new deadline on Monday?
It seemed pretty quiet today.
It has been quiet today. The only action I know of that will take place on Monday is the new deadline set by Mayor Cranley, and then the hearing with Judge Robert Ruhlman in state court.
And that hearing will, what's the immediate focus of that hearing?
It will be the preliminary hearing on a lawsuit that the homeless brought against the city of Cincinnati, alleging 1st, 4th, 8th, and 14th Amendment violations for what the city has done in regards to moving the camps around downtown.
I thought that lawsuit was in federal court.
The lawsuit. Did I misspeak? It's probably federal court.
Maybe I'm confused because there's a lot going on with this, but I think that the people experiencing homelessness brought their suit in federal court, and I think that's in front of Judge Timothy Black. And I think the hearing Monday in Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas is the action that's kind of unusual where the prosecutor sued the city of Cincinnati for the nuisance, and that's what led to the temporary restraining orders and all this other stuff. But from the beginning, there was this hearing on August 20th scheduled. So one of us is probably right.
Lucy, I'm going to defer to you.
That is absolutely correct. Yeah. I think you're right. I think it's moving on parallel paths.
Yes, exactly.
And has different issues at stake in each of those proceedings. What's happened, Lucy, over the last few weeks with the individuals who were living under Fort Washington Way and then on 3rd Street? What's actually happened to those people?
It's been a little bit hard to track what's happened to all of those people. When we were doing some in-depth reporting, we tried to get real specific numbers from the city. Start off by telling us exactly how many notices to vacate that you issued. The city says that for the folks at 3rd and Plum, that encampment that was sort of beneath an overpass, that they issued 24 notices to vacate. Now, it seemed like there were a lot more people there than 24 people. And then on the 3rd Street sidewalks, where visually it looked like even more people at some point, they said they issued 10 notices to vacate. And the city itself doesn't know exactly where each of those people has gone. So many different social service agencies have been involved in trying to help people. We've heard anecdotally from advocates that a number of them have decided to go into shelter, and their shelters have made room for them, that a number of them have gotten into housing programs. Some of the people who had been staying at these various camps have actually gotten keys for affordable housing, which is a huge step in the right direction for them. But there are still some people. Some of the remaining folks at 13th and Republic had a news conference earlier this week at the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition. I guess that was Wednesday, although it's getting to be a bit of a blur with some of these things. They said that everybody at that camp had applied for housing, but it's a process where there's not enough affordable housing in Hamilton County. It can be very difficult and kind of slow moving to get those things going. And I think that's part of why this delay was negotiated, to give folks a little bit more time to try to get into that housing so they didn't just have to pick up and move again.
My impression is there was two things going on there. One, give people a little bit more time. But secondly, there was an indication that there was movement, that organizations were being effective in helping people find places to live that wouldn't be outside. Sam, what is it that keeps people outside? There are people who are harder to place than others. What are some of the problems?
Absolutely. There are a lot of factors that contribute to homelessness and specifically staying outside. One of them can be mental illness. It's very difficult for people to use shelters who might be feeling anxious or paranoid because of a condition they have. Drug use and alcoholism is another factor that might deter someone from going into a shelter.
Because they can't use while they're there.
They cannot use while they're there. They would rather sleep outside than go through withdrawal and experience those symptoms, which can be very, very unpleasant. A few people that I've talked to also are part of couples, and that's what a lot of people in this 13th and Republic Street camp are married couples or people who are together who do not want to be separated, going to a men's shelter and a women's shelter separately and across town. And another lady I talked to, Miranda, with her dog Missy, she cannot take her into a shelter. So she has to stay outside or get rid of the only family that she has left, her dog.
Okay. So variety of things. And we don't know, but that could be some of the factors why certain people are still not placed. In some cases, people have been in shelters and have had problems with shelters and have been thrown out and can't come back.
Right.
So that sets up another dynamic that is a really big problem.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that I think we mentioned last week was none of the local shelters will take people who are registered sex offenders. So I don't know whether anybody in any of these camps is a registered sex offender, but that's something that if you've got that kind of offense on your record, you can't go into shelter because they won't take you.
Well, you know, there this question, Lucy, that you brought up that people are getting into affordable housing. And of course, that's what Over the Rhine Community Housing is all about. And that's it's property of Over the Rhine Community Housing, private property of Over the Rhine Community Housing, that this latest camp is on. Mm-hmm. But they've lost money in the past year. They've had $1 million cut out of their budget.
Yeah.
And so there's some real issues here of just finding enough housing.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And the funding that they lost was for a type of housing referred to as permanent supportive housing. And that's not only affordable housing, but it's also where they have a caseworker that works or a social worker who works directly with the person in the housing. So this is the best kind of housing for people who are hardest to serve, the chronically homeless, people with these mental illness issues that Sam mentioned, or even people with addiction problems. They really need someone to kind of walk through this journey with them. Sometimes it can take a few months. Sometimes it's for a few years until they're stabilized and can handle being in a house by themselves without that support. But this permanent supportive housing is really a critical first step for a lot of people who are the hardest to serve in the homeless community. They lost about $1 million in funding that they had been spending on permanent supportive housing. Now, there were some new programs that sort of offset some of that loss that our community as a whole got. But there are plenty of people in the community and the social services community who saw that as a big loss because Over the Rhine Community Housing is such a well-respected provider.
Yeah. Sam, you've been working on this all summer. And if you had to say what would be the one or two most effective things that could, as a community, we could adopt that would really change this in the future, what would you say?
I think if we could eliminate some of the barriers that prohibit people from moving into shelters, maybe the formation of a low barrier or no barrier shelter that would, and what I mean by that is a shelter where people could go that may not qualify for a different kind of shelter. Again, experiencing addiction, they might have animals with them, they might be part of a couple or a family. If we could have a facility that would allow them to get off the streets and into a transitional program where they would be three times less likely to die than they are sleeping out on the streets, that would be a huge step forward. Now, the problem is what neighborhood might want to volunteer that space and that kind of facility. That's a big unknown. And how much it costs, that would be a big unknown as well.
There are costs, though, involved in what we've got right now.
Yeah, there sure are. But there are also a lot of restrictions to the funding that comes into the community. So one of the things I talked to Kevin Finn about for the in-depth report we did a little bit earlier this week was that some of our listeners might be familiar with the Homeless to Homes plan. I'm sure you probably remember
yes.
that, Dan. That was launched in 2009, huge push by the city of Cincinnati to reduce homelessness. And these five new shelters that have been that were built between 2012 and 2015 were an important part of that plan and cost a total of $42 million to build. So the community invested a lot in that part of the plan. But there were also other parts of that plan that called for more affordable housing, more permanent supportive housing. There was even something in there called street outreach supportive housing. And the idea there was to have an apartment building where you could take people who had been camping outside and outreach workers could just let them move their tents into this apartment building so they could live exactly how they'd been living on the street, but in an apartment building. The tricky thing is that the only entity that funded housing like that is HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and right around the time that our community came up with that idea, HUD stopped funding new programs like that. So there was no money for it. So that was one of those recommendations that just didn't happen, which in hindsight is a real shame.
Well, supportive housing and Over the Rhine Community Housing has some of that. I mean, I think everybody, lots of people who are involved in this deeply, believe that is a key area of investment that we could make. Given the fact, Sam, that we have gone to the courts in this, this is now in the courts, what does this say about the future? I mean, there have been camps in the past. There have been homeless people living outside, either in camps or on their own, for a long time. But now that it's in the courts and people have said, you can't do this, what does this say about the future?
That's a great question. I think it says that we're going to make a decision about what to do with a lifestyle that can sometimes be very dangerous for people. Lucy, I kind of want to hear your thoughts, too, if you would like to jump in.
Sure, yeah. I think it could – there could be a good side to this in that, as Sam was kind of alluding to, it could force our hand as a community. If this becomes an issue with the courts, you know, the state court has kind of become its a whole own kettle of fish, so to speak. At the federal court level, we've kind of been here and done that before. There was a lawsuit in 2003, almost 15 years ago exactly, related to some gentlemen who were sleeping under the Clay Wade Bailey Bridge. A similar lawsuit was brought by a lawyer in town. There was a settlement that Judge Susan DeLotte oversaw in 2007. And that settlement is what actually led to having to give people 72-hour notice before the city cleared out their camps. There were some other, you know, really good moves made in that settlement, too. So maybe we can make more progress as a community kind of under the purview of the courts. But it also risks what people across the country refer to as the criminalization of homelessness. And that is, are we as a community going to say, you can get arrested just for being poor and for being homeless? And, you know, I think we as our community have to ask ourselves, do we want that, number one? Can our jails handle it, number two? And does that really solve anything long term?
Well, as a final question, Sam, I mean, now people violating the court order can be arrested. What's the point of that? Because the Justice Center is already overcrowded. Where does that get us?
I think that would create just such a negative image of a city that has been pretty compassionate to homeless people. The image of Cincinnati police officers or Hamilton County Sheriff's officers arresting people who are living outside and don't have anywhere else to go would just be a terrible way to end this saga that has borne some fruit. It has bore some fruit.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for being here. I do want to make the comment. We had Kevin Finn on Cincinnati Edition, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. And I have to say that I've looked at a lot of city plans since 1925. and the Homeless to Homes plan is the best plan I have ever seen. So if people, listeners, have not looked at that plan themselves and want to see a good, rational plan, that's it.
Still plenty of work to do in that plan, too.
Plenty of work to implement in that plan. So thank you very much for being here. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. An outbreak of hepatitis A, especially since one patient did work in a restaurant preparing food, has caused Northern Kentucky Health Department officials to recommend that everyone in the three-county region get a hepatitis A vaccination. That leaves lots of questions. We are joined now by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio, who has covered this story. If you would like to join the conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Terry, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So what is the extent of the problem as it's understood right now in the Northern Kentucky area?
Well, Northern Kentucky has, since January, acquired 56 diagnoses of hepatitis A. And while that is small compared to, say, Louisville, which a couple of months ago, I believe, had in the 500s. One of the things that was a little alarming was that July brought 22 of these 56 cases, and as of August 15th, there are another 16. So there's kind of a rapid outbreak now.
So, so ramping
that's
up.
Where we are.
Okay, so
exactly. That's the best way to put it.
So you mentioned the Louisville situation with over 500 cases. I understand there were some deaths in the Louisville area around hepatitis A. Is that right?
That's correct. And statewide, there have been 8 deaths in Kentucky. I checked this morning with the state health department. And that's since, I believe, August 4th or something around there. So we've had 8 deaths.
So how is hepatitis A transmitted?
Hepatitis A is a virus, so they treat symptoms like anything else. It is an inflammation of the liver, and people who get it may feel exhausted, a low appetite, nausea. It may be such that, you know, they want to go to a doctor and see what to do. It is not generally a lethal disease, infection, but it attacks the liver, and there could be long-term damage, and it can, you know, eventually it can cause death as well.
How long does it take from the time that a person is infected, which they wouldn't necessarily know, to the point where those sorts of symptoms that you were just describing begin to show up and they might, you know, even connect, oh my gosh, this is related to an exposure to hepatitis A?
Yeah, you know, I don't know exactly what that is, but I know that it's relatively quick, and that there are some people, though, who are asymptomatic. So I asked Dr. Lynn Sadler, you know, if people should get tested for it, and she said, really, you can. But the best thing to do is to prevent a further spread. So this is the reason that the Northern Kentucky Health Department is recommending that everybody be vaccinated.
Well, you know, that raises a lot of questions in my mind. I mean, everybody in Northern Kentucky is a lot of people.
Right.
Do doctors have a supply of the vaccine available? I mean, this
they
is...
Yeah, well, they've been ramping up for this for a while because Kentucky Health Department declared such an outbreak way back in November of 2017. Well, that's not way, but that's months. Over the summer, the Kentucky Department of Education decided to require that students be vaccinated. It's a two-step process. The health department, health clinics are definitely prepared, and most doctors' offices, family practice types that have, and pediatricians certainly are okay, but the best thing probably to do is to go ahead and make an appointment with your doctor, or your doctor's nurses, call in and make an appointment there.
So
and
when you said it's a two-step process, does that mean you have to get an initial shot and then a second shot in sequence?
That is true. There's an initial shot and then there's a booster that has to come 6 months afterward, not before 6 months, in other words, and shortly after that. But I know that a number of schools have allowed kids to come in with just the initial shot. That was a situation that I think, and this is really basically my knowledge as a parent, a lot of parents weren't aware of, you know, having to get their kids vaccinated. And so that caused a little bit of a rush on some doctors.
What about, are there other
counters?
Now, you mentioned doctors, pediatricians, health clinics. Is this going to be available like a flu shot through CVS or Walgreens or those sorts of places, Kroger's? Is it going to be that available? Or because that's the way you get to a lot of people in a hurry.
That's the truth, you know, Dan. And I'm not sure, but that would be my assumption as well. And we would just be looking for those kinds of signs of, like, the Kroger Little Clinic when they usually put up, you know, get this vaccination here, this one. I'll keep an eye on that, though, as to whether we may end up with a run on these vaccines.
Any sense of a cost for what a person would have to pay to get this vaccine?
Oh, I wish I had this information. I'm sorry I'm ill-prepared for that. I do not know what the cost is. I do know that most insurance covers it. Medicaid also does cover it. That doesn't mean that there is no copay to see a doctor, but it is something that most insurances will cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, Terry, when given the fact that this has been put out there by the Northern Kentucky Health Department, from, you know, a parent's point of view, from, you know, just an observer, a resident's point of view, do you feel like people should feel compelled to go do this? This is not just, oh, a warning. This is something they really should do.
You know, it's interesting. I really do think so. Now, although the original outbreaks were mainly pinned to injection drug users, homeless people, this has gotten into, you know, just food service places, and it's kind of being passed from person to person. Hamilton County has 22 current cases, and they were, you know, injecting people in the jail with the vaccination. Until I talked to a friend of mine who works in Frankfurt, I thought, well, this must just be something for the kids to get. And he told me everybody is getting it there. I really hadn't thought much about it, but there was that. And then within days, I got the notice, the alert from the Northern Kentucky Health Department. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go.
Yeah.
I really think that people should heed this.
Any sense of why Kentucky is experiencing this? I mean, I can see we're a particular locality, but why is it seems like it's in several localities in Kentucky. Any sense of why that's happening?
I think it's probably because, you know, or started because, again, of the opioid epidemic with injection drug users.
Mm.
West Virginia is crushed with it. I just talked briefly with Dr. Judith Feinberg, who used to be in infectious diseases at UC, and
Absolutely.
Now she's at West Virginia University. They're experiencing it. Michigan, Ohio, although it's a little bit less so far in Hamilton County. And these are all areas that have been hard hit by the opioid epidemic. It's just that this is so easy to pass along. I think more people are becoming infected with it than, for example, hepatitis C.
Yes. Terry, thank you very much for this reporting. And I think it just alerts everybody, whether you're in Northern Kentucky or in Southwest Ohio, it's something to be talking to your doctor about and make sure that you get what you need. So thank you very much for
Absolutely.
Your reporting and also for being with us today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Last Tuesday, Vice President Mike Pence came to Cincinnati to tout Republican tax cuts and to help raise money for Congressman Steve Shabbat and Brad Winstrup and Senate candidate Jim Renacci. This coming week, President Trump will be in Columbus to stump for candidates he is supporting. This help from Trump and Pence is not without its complications, especially for gubernatorial candidate Mike DeWine, who's trying not to get damaged by the split between President Trump and Ohio Governor John Kasich. To assess where all these races stand, we are joined now by WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson, Cincinnati Enquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmert, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. If you would like to join the conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We are also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody, to Cincinnati Edition, and we are getting close to that Labor Day moment where the flag seems to drop and everything begins to happen in political races. So, Jesse, given that Governor Kasich's the most prominent Republican, elected Republican around the country who has been openly criticizing President Trump and probably laying the groundwork for a run for himself in 2020. What's the dynamic whenever Trump enters the state of Ohio? He's going to be in Columbus this coming week. What's the dynamic and how does everybody else have to shuffle out in relationship to that?
So it's such a fascinating dynamic that has really been going on for years now. When John Kasich and Donald Trump were both candidates for the presidency on the GOP side, and it really hasn't ended. Really, just this week, the president was tweeting about how John Kasich hurt the candidate in the 12th congressional district in central Ohio. And John Kasich was on the Sunday shows saying Donald Trump hurt this same candidate in the 12th district. And so I don't think you will see that reducing anytime soon. I think it plays to both of their interests to keep this up a little bit. And it is awkward for candidates such as the Republican in the 12th district who won the endorsements of both of those popular candidates.
Ultimately
yeah. won both Trump and Kasich support. And for the GOP candidate running for governor, Mike DeWine, who has already gotten some support from the president, and the governor has said that he plans to vote for and support DeWine. So once again, you have two people who agree on very little in politics, but are both very popular in Ohio politics, and candidates are going to have to kind of, you know, walk the line between these two.
Joe Ingles with Ohio Public Radio, State House News. Let's talk a little bit more about Mike DeWine's situation here. How's Mike DeWine tried to maneuver? How's he played this so far? How's his approach as, wanting DeWine's enthusiastic support, but also obviously wanting the president's support?
Yeah, I mean, the way he's played it is he hasn't played it, honestly. He's not talking about it. He tries to steer clear from it. He has not been out there at the Trump rallies so far, you know, banging the drum saying, hey, I'm all for Trump. He's all for me. But he hasn't talked about Trump in a negative way either. He really doesn't do that. He's trying to ride down the middle. And, that's the thing. You know, when you're in that primary, it might be a great thing to be over there on the far right, because that will get you some votes with the primary voters. But when you go into the general election, and especially statewide, we've seen Ohio is really a purple state. It's not really red or blue, despite the fact that right now it's controlled by all red pretty much. But it really is a purple state if you look at the history of it. And so he's trying to get right in there in the middle. If he takes sides with Kasich, then he alienates some of the voters there. If he takes sides with Trump, he alienates voters there. So the way that he's played it is kind of right down the middle, not disparaging either one, not, you know, being out there asking either one to be, you know, very supportive of him. But, you know, how long can he keep that up? And with Governor Kasich, I mean, there's the question of, does it really kind of hurt his brand with the middle if he's out there supporting the same people as Trump? And, you know, is there like, does it make him look more, you know, what do we want to say, partisan with that voter that's in the middle? And that's who he's trying to cater to with a not announced supposed presidential run, maybe sometime.
Howard, the problem has been laid out here for Mike DeWine. What are the dangers here for him?
Well, he's between a rock and a hard place, and he's not going to get out of that anytime soon. That's just a fact of life. You know, we had a primary season, as Jesse was talking about, and Joe, the where Trump kind of hung over the whole atmosphere, and DeWine tried to stay clear of that. He needs Trump voters, but he doesn't need Trump. He needs the independent voters. He needs the people that, you know, who look at Trump and say, well, we may agree with him on this issue or that issue. We don't like him. We don't like him. And if he's too closely identified with Trump, it's not going to help him. And it's going to help Rich Cordray, the Democratic candidate for governor, make a better case to say, look, we know Donald Trump doesn't like me. That's clear for me.
And even to that point, Rich Cordray, who's the Democrat running for governor, came out and said he had a video saying, if you like John Kasich, you'll like me because I'm going to keep Medicaid expansion and I'm okay with this Jobs Ohio public-private partnership on economic development. And so you see Rich Cordray going after those people who support John Kasich, in part because John Kasich is more popular with Democrats than Republicans right now in Ohio.
He is the most popular Republican among Democrats, not only here in Ohio, but anywhere in the country right now.
Yeah. In fact, I want to come back to the economic plans that both people have released recently. But Cordray, in several places in that plan, expressly cites his agreement with Kasich. And so I want to come back to that. But Jesse, just looking at the other side of this for a moment, obviously Rich Cordray and I would say other Democratic candidates clearly have some sort of polling data says that a big issue here is healthcare. I mean, it's just at the top.
Picked up
of
on that?
It's just at the top of every stump speech and everything that's being put out. So, how do you think that's playing? How do you think? Because, as President Trump found out, there's nothing easy about healthcare here. So, it's not a simple thing to get involved in this.
It's true, but I think there's this debate going on even nationally in the Democratic Party about whether they need to be picking kind of centrist candidates like the guy from the 12th district in Central Ohio or the Pennsylvania candidate who are successful, or whether they should really be digging into Medicare for All, $15 minimum wage, these like really hardcore progressive issues. And I think you see healthcare more in the middle. That's something that maybe a Republican who leans Democratic or Democrat who leans Republican can get on board with. And they've really been hitting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and whether people would keep pre-existing conditions and whether they would keep Medicaid expansion. I think it's partially because those are two very popular programs, and Trump has been hesitant to say he's going to keep portions of it. And so I think especially on the federal level, like in your congressional cases and your U.S. Senate race, you're going to hear that a lot, but a little bit on the local level too. And I think it's an issue kind of in the middle that people can agree on as opposed to firing up the base.
Yeah. Joe, on that healthcare question, people running for Congress or for Senate, they'll be in a position to have some say over that. But actually, the president will still be in the White House, and it's still going to be tough to change the direction of what has happened here. The repeal and replace, as some people say, they've gotten the repeal down pretty well, but there hasn't been much replacement here of anything.
Right, right. And you see, you know, when President Trump first took office, you'll remember at the fight over health care, you know, a lot of the people who helped elect President Trump were some of the very people who went out and said, wait a minute, wait, we're all against Obamacare, but don't go messing with the Affordable Care Act. We like that. You know, there seemed to be some misunderstanding among a lot of voters that were cited in newspaper articles and our news stories here, people saying, you know, we really like the premise of this Affordable Health Care Act. When you're, you know, calling it Obamacare and we thought it was something else, you know, free health care for all or socialized medicine or whatever they thought it was, they didn't like that. So now there's kind of a, you know, you saw this big outcry at the beginning of the Trump era, and now he's had to scale back. And what he's been doing piece by piece is kind of dismantling some of the things that make it solid, make it so that it can operate, you know, taking away some of the mandates and those sort of things. So the thing is, though, you're right about the president, you know, making those decisions, but Congress will have a say in a lot of pieces of it. Okay. And I think that's the thing that they're trying. And don't forget, too, that Congress also could have something to do with whether this president, all the problems that have been following him, if they continue to keep going on and on and on, you know, some of these people that could be elected to Congress could actually end up voting to impeach him or something, you know, down the line. So there's that, too. So there's a lot going on besides just the actual nuts and bolts of the healthcare problem. But people are looking at that healthcare problem saying, we want someone who can backstop for us.
You know, Howard, just before we get off of sort of the relationship of Washington politics mm-hmm. and state politics, much less local politics, what does a visit like Mike DeWine to Cincinnati this past week?
You mean Pence?
Pardon me. Thank you.
Yes. Okay.
Vice President Pence.
Yeah.
To Cincinnati, what's that do for the congressional candidates for Shabbat and Winstrup? Is that important?
Not much. Okay. I mean, really, it's not much. I mean, he was at a private fundraising event for Mike DeWine. They had a so-called panel discussion of Rob Portman, Steve Shabbat, Jim Renacci, and Brad Winstrup. So you had four people supposedly debating the Trump tax cuts when all four of them agreed on the Trump tax cuts. I mean, it was just a kind of a dog and pony show. But the one thing that Pence said, and the only thing that Pence said about the healthcare issue, and it got a big applause line, people stood up and cheered for him, was, we got rid of the individual mandate. And that's the one thing they can point to and say, because that was one of the unpopular parts. People wanted to keep the popular parts that, you know, we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
But they can point to that and say, we got rid of that. See, we're effective.
So let's move on to the Cordray-DeWine race. Both Cordray and DeWine issued economic development plans this week. And I don't know. Let's see. Jesse, as you read those two, do you see much difference? What's your reaction to these plans?
You know, I'm going to be perfectly honest and say I haven't drilled down into all of them, but the broad strokes of them seem like we're focusing a lot on, you know, development of career tech and those types of things, apprenticeship programs, which are things that the state has been really focused on for a while. There has been a lot of attention on, you know, people who shouldn't be going to a four-year or college degree program and maybe should go to a two-year program or apprenticeship program, and that would be better served for them, their career needs, and just their interests, and also financially.
Which is also an echo of John Kasich.
Which is something John Kasich has also focused on. So I heard a lot of similar ideas in some regards. There's only so many ideas out there. It makes sense that you would want to focus on that, especially after there was such a drive for everyone to go to a four-year college. But I didn't see too many differences was actually at the event.
The thing about what Cordray said was No Ohioan should have to go to college in order to find a pathway to success in the middle class. And that was, you know, that was his message, and that there are alternatives. And Jesse laid some of those out. It really did strike me as very similar to some of the things that Kasich had said in, I believe, his last or his next to last
State of the State
address. Yeah.
You know, Joe, one of the things that I found interesting in DeWine's plan was that a proposal that the governor would have the power to suspend regulations that he believes are interfering with economic development and job growth. That's an interesting set of powers to be leveraging and trying to get into the governor's hands. That was one that popped out at me.
Yeah, you know, and that's one that would be hard to nail down as to how exactly that could happen other than, you know, vetoes and that kind of thing. Because the legislature that we have, if you look at some of the things it's been doing, it's been trying to take back power away from the governor so much, you know, in a lot of ways. So, but they have cut down in, you know, regulations during this administration, the Kasich administration, regulations that they see as unwieldy. What exactly he means by that, I'm not really sure. He went into that whole thing about the opportunity zones and attracting private investment in these economically impaired areas of the state and how they could do that. So maybe, you know, he's kind of looking at some ways to get over some hurdles there, provide, you know, some incentives that would help. And there's regulations in there that can, you know, cause a problem or whatever. But yeah. That's really one of those things that he can talk about, but you have to really drill down on it to know what it means.
If he got his way on that, let's say he got his way on that and becomes governor of the state of Ohio, the Ohio Supreme Court is going to be very, very busy because there are a whole lot of these things that are going to end up.
And
in
I think
court.
To Joe's point, the state legislature, which is run by Republicans, is not going to just be like, oh, no, take our authority.
Take our authority.
As
away
John
from
Kasich
us.
Has found, just because you're on the same party doesn't mean they're going to want to let go of these powers.
And that's why I say the Ohio Supreme Court's going to have its hands full because they're going to be the ones that end up having to sort it out.
Well, here's the question for, I don't know who wants to jump on this, but does anybody except geeks like us really read these plans, and do they have any impact?
Oh, gosh. Oh, probably lots of geeks like us. But I do think when you talk to voters about what are the key issues in the election, they're going to say the economy and they're going to say jobs. And so I think to that extent, it does matter a whole lot. I think both Cordray and DeWine are facing an issue where unemployment is relatively low in this state. And job growth, though slow, and wage growth, though slow, have been happening. And so you can't take the approach that John Kasich took with Ted Strickland in the middle of the recession saying, you know, everything is horrible and I'm here to save the day. It has to be a little more nuanced. And I think because of that, it's a little harder to wrap your mind around.
Let's move on to the senatorial campaign and Sherrod Brown, Jim Renacci. And Joe, the Renacci campaign is very clear what its attack line is. You know, that Brown's a far left extremist, he's dangerous. How's that playing with independents and swing voters?
Well, you know, right now it's really too early to see because I really think, honestly, at least up here in central Ohio, we've had all this attention around that 12th district congressional race, and people have been paying attention to that. They're not really paying attention a lot to what's coming out with the U.S. Senate race.
They're not paying attention down here either, Joe.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that people are paying attention right now, honestly. Yeah. But, you know, I think that has the potential and, you know, to be something that people will pay attention to. I think people are just kind of zoned out right now and sick of politics and they don't want to hear about it. So,
one of the
problems that Renacci faces is he's running against a incumbent Democrat who's clearly a liberal populist type Democrat, but there are some issues on which he is fairly close to President Trump.
On the tariffs.
On the tariffs, on trade policy, international trade agreements, on some of those type of issues. And those are issues that won Donald Trump a lot of votes in Ohio in 2016, right. Especially in eastern Ohio and up and down the Ohio River.
Howard, there's a something I want to throw to you as on a local question. In the Shabbat-Purval mm-hmm. race, there's a mini controversy around will they debate or won't they debate?
Yeah.
And how significant, new, different is any of this?
Well, I've been doing this since 1974. There's every single year there's been debates about debates. And usually some happen, but not as many as say, non-incumbents would like and probably more than incumbents would like. But in the end, they will at some point sit down face-to-face and talk. Now, in the case of Aftab Purival and Steve Shabbat, which is a Democrats have targeted that race in the Ohio First District. He's already accepted four debates.
Purival.
Yeah. Three of the network TV stations and Cincinnati.com, The Enquirer, and Fox are going in together on one that they are willing to host. Now, you know, Aftab Purival says, I'll take all of them, any one of them, anytime, any place, you know, I'll do it on a street corner, I'll do it on the Washington Park. So far, the Shabbat campaign has not said whether or not they would accept any of them. And that's not unusual for a candidate who is the incumbent, who has been around for a very long time, and in this case is really truly threatened mm-hmm. by a newcomer candidate.
Sort of a debate can only turn out bad.
Right.
It's hard to imagine. I do want to point out, this is very personal, the only time Steve Shabbat sat down with his opponent 2 years ago was on Newsmakers on my show.
Hosted by you.
And the fact that I taught Steve Shabbat in high school had something to do with that.
He's
always been responsive to me, so I appreciate that. So anyway, one final question, and Jesse, let me throw this to you. A report coming out about state local school districts, 600 of them, that, the DeRolf case in 1999, they still haven't invested the money that the Supreme Court told them they were supposed to. Are you surprised?
No, I don't think anyone who's covered this over the past several decades is surprised. It is disappointing, and I think every budget year there's an opportunity for them to fix it. So we'll see what happens next year.
We'll see what happens next year. I want to thank Joe Ingles, Jesse Ballmer, and Howard Wilkinson for being here this afternoon. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website at WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley.